Recording.
Yeah, we're going now. Yes, just for the people who may be listening, Maria and Nick were just discussing what it is to have a self, I guess the first thing that brings to mind is that if you've done your Metzinger reading, he doesn't actually address that question directly. It's a kind of a rather fascinating omission that he assumes that we know what a self is already. And of course, the question of what it is to be a self, what you mean by a self, is sort of fundamental to a book like The Ego Tunnel, which is claiming that our sense of self is an illusion. So I think we'll go into that. But just a little bit of background on Thomas Metzinger, which you probably picked up. He's a big player in the world of the scientific study of consciousness. And that's why I chose him as a reading, because up until now, we've been looking at what the phenomenologists have to say, if you like, about science. That's been the theme. And we had a, you know, Eagleman's documentary at the beginning was a sort of a little taste of popular science and what popular science has to say about the brain, but it wasn't, a BBC documentary isn't a serious attempt to try and explain the understanding that science has of consciousness. Whereas I had a careful look at who should I pick if I was just going to give you one person to give you an account of how science understands consciousness. And I thought Metzinger's a good candidate. The way this world is that nobody fully agrees with anybody, because it's still a work in progress. But there is a kind of a background understanding that's in Metzinger that is shared by many of the people in this area. And partly I'm bringing this up because I'm peripherally involved with these people. So, for instance, he founded the Association for the Scientific Study of Consciousness, and I've delivered a paper there, for instance. And the key people who are involved at Sussex University in that domain would be Anil Seth, who I know and took over teaching a course from him. So that, and Dave Chalmers, who's maybe the founder of this, almost this modern interest in the scientific study of consciousness, was a co-supervisor of me when I was studying philosophy. So I've got a little, I'm still peripheral. I'm not a big player in that area, but I know these people, and I've encountered their work, and it's partly because of that that I'm teaching this course. You know, because I'm trying, in some sense or other, I'm trying to bring some light into some light phenomenology into this world that studies consciousness without really being connected to that phenomenological tradition. So there's the Association for the Scientific Study of Consciousness. There's a big emphasis on the word scientific. More emphasis on scientific than consciousness. And as Maria was saying from reading Metzinger, it doesn't sound like that because the word phenomenology is used a lot. So yes, in what he said, you think, oh yeah, he's aware of phenomenology. He's taking it very seriously. But what Metzinger means by phenomenology isn't the philosophical endeavour started by Husserl. What he means by phenomenology is actually allowing the first person experience, the accounts of individuals, to enter into your description of consciousness. So phenomenology is to in the lab almost, is to actually ask somebody what they're experiencing. and ask them to describe it. That's considered to be practicing phenomenology, to actually take somebody's account of what they're experiencing as data that you include in your understanding of what consciousness is. Now, I'd like you just to pause and realize how incredible it would be to think you could study consciousness without doing that. that should become a kind of a breakthrough that we should actually consider, interrogating people about what it is they're experiencing in an attempt to understand what consciousness is. But it's replaced behaviorism, and behaviorism actually, Carla actually said, the internal experience of consciousness of having some kind of inner life is utterly irrelevant to our understanding of what it is to be a human being or an animal. Maria.
Isn't it impossible to study anything without first-person experience? Because if you don't...
You've done too much phenomenology, proper phenomenology. I'm glad you said it. Of course. It's in a certain sense, it is impossible. But not if you fully inhabit what's considered a third-person scientific objective perspective. Now, the thing that you should say, or maybe you're going to say, is in fact, you can't even inhabit that position unless, first of all, you're a conscious individual. Okay. But this is what we're going into. There's a kind of a madness, almost, at work here, in the view that Metzinger takes of consciousness, that I'd just like to get across in a way by looking at what he's actually saying. But I prejudice the whole discussion by saying that in a way. But just to begin with, I think we just should look. I'd like to take, because there's what Metzinger is describing is a mixture of actual facts, yes, actual observations about things that are actually occur. And actual information that we have about how the brain functions, the entire account is threaded through with what we would consider scientific facts. So it's not when you read it, you're not reading somebody who is telling you things that aren't true in any obvious way. You know, the surface of what Metzinger is saying is about a lot of things that have been discovered that are true and have changed our understanding of how the brain works. But at the same time, running through it is a certain set of preconceptions. And I hope you realise now from our studying of philosophy, as philosophers, you've got to read under the surface of what's being said to look at what are the preconceptions that are operating here, and are the preconceptions in any way, where have they come from? How do they alter or shape the meaning of what's being said? And if you're just doing pure neuroscience, it's all the fact that you're taking a scientific perspective when you're studying the behaviour of neurons in a certain sense is justifiable. But when you're doing philosophy, which Metzinger is self-consciously doing philosophy, he's trying to say, well, what does it all mean? If you're doing philosophy, then the presuppositions that you bring to bear are essentially what philosophy is about. But I was going to say some more about Metzinger's background. Carla, do you mind just shifting around a bit so I can see you? It's funny having you here. Having you.
Sit here, Carla, next to me. Shall I move around?
So, yes, Metzinger's an interesting figure. You see, he's about my age. And he's part of that kind of culture that we've all it's an odd thing to I was just listening to someone over the weekend who said, you can't really say that you're a member of a generation anymore, because people are different decade by decade now. You know, you're identified by the decade you came from, rather than the back when I was younger, I guess there was the whole 60s and 70s generation, and there was a whole swathe of people, you know, stretching over much more than a decade, who are a member of that kind of generation. And Metzinger's a member, if you like, of my generation. He, as a teenager, he would have been listening to rock music and taking drugs. You can tell. And he was having all kinds of crazy experiences. No doubt he'd done LSD. You know, he's not some dry academic from the 1930s. You know, he's not from Heidegger's world. He's from our world, or my world. You know, I hesitate to say in a way what it's like now to be young. I don't want to assume anything, but I think it's quite different to how it was when I was young. And there's probably aspects of how the world is for you that I just don't, it's not part of almost my phenomenology. Do you know that? And it's hard. If you were giving the class, you'd probably start to inform me more about, how it is for you. It's only that I was reflecting on this over the weekend. That's partly why I'm bringing it up. But anyway, for me, Metzinger's he's not like Heidegger. He's not some elder talking from the distant past. He's a kind of a peer of mine. And he also had out-of-body experiences as a teenager that I think he found utterly shocking and disturbing, and were actually the foundation of a lot of the work that he's doing. I think that caused him to say, how on earth can I have had these out-of-body experiences and at the same time fit that together with my scientific, because he embraced a sort of a scientific worldview, with my scientific worldview. How could I have out-of-body experiences and be a member of this scientific community? He needed to it's all right, Tex, come in. He needed to try and make the two things fit together. And if you like, the ego tunnel is his attempt, I think, to do that. I'm just giving you that as a bit of human background. Part of the human background for Metzinger is he's trying to make sense of how on earth do out-of-body experiences happen without us concluding that in some way that we're sort of really, the reality is that we're disembodied spirits that are somehow or other can get out of our bodies and look back on our bodies. You can't espouse a view like that and be a member of the contemporary scientific culture. You can, you obviously, if you don't matter, you can. But if you matter, right? If you want to be a player, you know, somebody who is significant, you just can't go around believing. I mean, I've been there, right? That would be considered believing in spooks, and that's all very well for the New Age and all the rest of it, but you know, you can't expect to get grant money or have any real standing in the world if you believe in spooks. So to a certain extent, this is how Metzinger is attempts to explain. I mean, to a certain level, you might say, if you're one of the people who believes in spooks, that he's trying to explain away the idea that there's astral bodies and all the rest of it. Yes? And this is his account of that. And it begins with something very, very visceral, which is the rubber hand illusion, which I really feel I should, because I mention this a lot in my, you know, teaching, I should have really have undergone it. I believe it's true to the extent I haven't even bothered to see if it is true. But if you are not familiar with it, there's a sort of a diagram there. That grey box on the left, your hand's in a box. It's hidden, right? You can't see it. And there's just a rubber hand lying on the table, and it's even chopped off. You know, it's a bit like, you know, last week when we were with Saving Private Ryan and the arm had fallen off on the beach. It's a bit like that. And all that's happening is there's a little, like a little wooden stick stroking one of your fingers, and simultaneously it's stroking the finger of the rubber hand that you can see, and you can't see your own actual hand. And after a while, quite reliably, I think almost all people experience this, you have a shift, and you suddenly start experiencing the feeling of the stimulation as occurring spatially in the rubber hand. Now, for I think this was a eureka moment for Metzinger, because suddenly it became clear to him, oh my God, your whole experience of your body is completely manipulable. Yes, it's not as if you actually inhabit your body and you feel the sensation of that's in your foot because you've got you might be thinking, I've got nerves in my feet and my nerves are sensitive, so what I feel is what my nerves are feeling. Yeah. Now this is an absolute disproof of that. And if you don't believe it, if you experience it, it is, yes.
I read this carefully and I could not see whether they tried to maybe have a control where the stroking of the hidden hand did not match the stroking or the sensations or the what was happening visually in the rubber hand. So, for instance, you know, that there's something stroking the finger of the rubber hand and something stroking, and then the person could report, oh yes, I now imagine that it's happening to this hand. And then suddenly what goes on over here is this. Is that not felt?
Yeah, it has to be coordinated. But in fact, what they really do in these experiments is they take a hammer and they smash the rubber hand.
And you experience...
You go, like, yeah, that's what you do. You just have a horrible shock. Well, yes.
Yeah, but have they done it the other way round? I don't mean smashing.
No, but if there's a discontinuity, I'm pretty sure that the illusion dissipates.
Exactly.
Yeah, no, it's like all illusions. You're being I'm so pleased, Maria. You're starting to be a phenomenologist.
Well, I've had out of the body experiences, and yes. I know that as soon as you see, or certainly for me,
Delphine. Yes.
When you see your body on the bed.
Yeah.
You instantly go back into your body. You don't remain... Well, I haven't remained floating, going, interesting, yes, I put my body on the bed.
Just make me take some chair space for Delphine.
The illusion dissipates, is what I'm saying.
Yes. I'll slip around here. As long as if I pull this around, we won't trip over that, will we?
So I don't really see...
No, the all of these illusions... Delphine, here's fine. If you... you don't have to join... All right. We're about to run out of chairs. Oh, no. We've got one chair left.
You've got no one.
Oh, we've got another one there. No, we're about to...
Joe might turn up, too. You know,
we're about to have exceeded our... Yeah, it's becoming less of a circle and more of a class, isn't it?
Yeah. And we should leave one chair out for Joe, because she does...
Yeah,
we've
got one.
Bring it round, yeah. So we don't just bring it round. So
oh, Nicolette's in. Nicolette's.
Well, no, she does.
Nicolette's been running education sessions at the hospice, so she's in her element. Right, this is for the unexpected guests.
There is one case of one guy that he had a stroke when he was 11 years old. That is very uncommon. So usually the strokes are in people of 40, 50, 60. But there are some cases where it's in very young people. And what happened, his brother studied neuroscience because he was with problems and everything. And together, they started to do all these activities. And they, in a book, they show how works very well. Already the guy that is 11, that was 11 years old and had a stroke, he created, like, the organization is a global world organization of people that had a stroke. And he showed all these experiments and showed how he could develop. Now he's totally normal. And with all these kind of exercises, for example, he was showing how also if you have problems to move legs or arms, only watching people doing exercise, do that the brain that make some signals that move the muscles and everything.
Yes.
Without doing the exercise.
Yes. Yes, and I this
is a good example because
that's something different. It's to do with predictive processing, which in effect when you and mirror neurons. So when you actually observe somebody doing something, you actually invoke the motor commands that would make you do that thing, just by the observation. And I remember one of the things that they realised about that was, you know, when people have Botox that freezes their face, and you sense there's something weird about it. It's because, in actual fact, people mirror your expression very, very subtly in the face. You know, if somebody smiles like that, you know, you smile. You feel yourself smile. You see, like we yawn or we smile. We actually we know what someone else is feeling because we copy. The whole motor command goes through us as well.
And the interpretation is subconscious.
Yeah, and we feel the feeling partly we feel the feeling of somebody's happy and you smile because you smiled.
When you're observing groups of people discussing something, you can always tell when somebody disagrees because everybody vibrates a little bit. And when somebody disagrees with what someone's saying, that stops. Even if they're not conscious of it. And also they stop mirroring.
Yeah.
You know, so, I mean...
No, I feel that happened with me. I was, when I'm in... It's very rare that I can sit and listen to any kind of meeting without disagreeing. when I'm not disagreeing, I'm thinking, oh gosh, this is nice. It's disagreeing isn't nice, is it? In a way, it's kind of because you know that you've got to
cut off from the
you cut off from that empathy with everybody else. The rubber hand illusion, but does at the same time indicate the fact. That your sense of your body is something that is occurring in your brain, because it can be manipulated in this way. Now, what Maria is saying is yes, but that illusion can only survive very briefly, and as soon as you get conflicting evidence, you go back to the if you like the correct interpretation of where your body is. But the rubber hand illusion, it shows that it is an illusion to think that you actually sense what's going on in your hand. That's not where it happens. Yeah.
There is a disease called radioculopathy that is a nerve trap in the spine in the C6 C7. And then you start to feel that your arm is broken and your arm is perfect.
Yes.
But you feel that it is broken. Or you feel pins and needles, and there is no reason to feel this because nothing is happening. But your brain receives some orders because the electric circuit is broken.
Yes. Yeah.
You feel like it's broken, it's hot, it's many things that there is no reason, real physical reason, to have this.
Yes,
sensation.
Yes, and you see, this is for Metzinger. This is crucial to his understanding of out-of-body experiences. So he gets more involved in other experiments where instead of just having a rubber hand, you have a rubber body, and you can actually induce the illusion that you're inhabiting another body under the right circumstances. Again, similar to the rubber hand, but you've got an entire body that's being stimulated in the way that your body's being stimulated, and you can actually get the experience, if you like, of an out-of-body experience. But it involves also, you see, you have to have the right, you have to have the first-person perspective. So I forget the nature, the exact nature of the experiment, but you have to have some virtual reality goggles going on as well. So that you have to be seeing as if you were from the point of view of that body. You can't, if you're seeing the body as absolutely distinct from you, that's too much. But
what did amputees then? He must have studied amputees or something.
I don't think he mentions them. Does he in the reading?
No, he don't. But amputated limb.
Yeah, Merleau-Ponty is. Did a lot on amputees.
That they've got the limb. You know, yes. They have the sensation of the limb.
Yes.
And the phantom pains.
Yes.
And that's concretely evident.
Yes.
It's been.
Yes, that's all part of when we were saying about predictive processing, which I hesitate to give you a reading about predictive processing because that's the current kind of theory of this group, if you like, who are studying consciousness. Is that basically what the brain is doing is it's predicting what it's, I think we've mentioned this before, what it's expecting to be the case now on the basis of past experience, not just distant past experience of being in rooms and being in lectures, right down to the last millisecond ago. The last millisecond, if I start moving my hand, tells you where you expect my hand to be. So there's all of these different temporal levels at this moment predicting what should be happening next. And the phantom limb is a prediction of there being a limb that was based on the past of there having been a limb, although there's even evidence that people predict having limbs who are born without limbs. That there's a genetic, if you like, component in that prediction, but the entire body is being its shape, and the experience of it is there's something that's predicting everything. It's there's a prediction inwardly as well about what it's going to feel like to touch the table before it, and as you do touch the table, I mean you catch this when you're walking down some steps and you miss a step, you're aware then of the prediction that you had in your it seemed like in your foot that there was going to be a step there, and how finely tuned it is as well. You know, you're slowing down exactly in the right way to stop on that step. So that predictive processing theory pretty much says that that's the entire job of the neocortex. The entire outer surface of the brain is engaged in this prediction. That's going. When I say it's going down, it's because it's meeting what's coming in through the senses. And the general thinking now is that what's coming in through the senses is not what you're experiencing. What you're experiencing is the prediction. Insofar as the prediction matches what the senses are reporting, but what the senses are reporting. In terms information-wise, is about 10% maybe of what you're actually experiencing.
A tiny quick point as well. I think there's some people have reported a small delay between losing a limb and then suddenly going in certain accounts that I've seen on trauma stories.
Yes.
People say, I didn't feel anything. It was a little nick or something.
Yes.
Or nothing.
Yes.
And then suddenly it was I was in major pain.
Yes.
And so there's this delay, which is more than you'd think. Just on sense.
Yes.
Senses. You think
yes.
It's pretty immediate.
But and but you see the gist of it is that what he wants to say is we are under a kind of an illusion when you look at it scientifically that we've really got that we really have the feeling in our hands. What he's about to say is our whole experience of having a body is a kind of a projection coming out of the brain. I think it's important to kind of absorb this, because this is the he's going to draw immense conclusions from this, and our civilization is drawing immense conclusions from this.
Isn't it just a shorthand? I mean, I'm sitting in this chair, so all the sensations that the chair is giving my body, in a way, I don't need to pay attention to that. So, if you like, the continuation of that sensation might be being predicted. But if a spring suddenly came out of the chair and, you know, I kind of felt that, it would no longer be something that's predicted. It's something.
The fact that it's a spring. And this is from this model. The fact you could even identify it as a spring is you're experiencing a certain hypothesis to explain what's come through the senses.
But it's come through the senses.
It's come through the senses. But the fact that you experience it as a spring, that's something that you're predicting.
It's an explanation. I mean, if
not just an explanation, but it's like. Something like this. If you were to take the prediction away, it's the best analogy that we have that I can give you is when you've got a radio playing in the background and it's all and then suddenly you recognise the song and you hear the song. You hear all the words, the chords, everything. That sound of the radio and the static and the has the you know this kind of is like that's the raw, that's what in a way a kind of an experience of what the ears are picking up before you recognize it. And as soon as you recognize it, it's not that you're saying, oh, it's a theory. I think that's that song. It's not a theory. It's when you recognize it that you hear the song. And similarly with the spring, the brain goes, it's a spring that's come through the chair, and then you experience it as a spring in all its detail. And if the brain isn't predicting it, then all the detail goes out of it. And the raw sensation, and I mean, I know that there isn't any, raw sensation is a bit of a misnomer. The signals that are entering through the eye and through the information that's available in those nerves, I've worked on robots, cameras, sensors, and there isn't enough detail in there to specify the world. Yeah, the specification of the detailed world in which we live is absolutely reliant on our having experienced it before and made sense of it before, and our sort of streaming neural signals that are coming down. That are able to take the limited information coming in through the senses and make it into to this detailed experience that we're having now.
But even if it was a dog sitting on the chair and a spring came out, it would feel it.
Yeah, well, the dog
might not say, "Oh, that was a spring."
No, the dog's got a neocortex, of course. So it's doing the same thing.
It would feel the sensation. It might not be able to say to itself, "Oh, this chair's nagged; a spring's just come out of it." But it still feels it, doesn't it?
No, it doesn't. Language comes later.
Yes, but even without language, the sensation.
I'm saying in the dog will have interpreted what's happened, that sensory information according to its past experience, because it's got a neocortex just like us.
Yeah. So it feels pain.
Yes, but not just feels pain, the dog sees another dog because it's seen other dogs before. The dog recognises you because the dog's seen you before. The dog's doing the same. The dog, it's not just a human thing, this. The dog's body is just as susceptible to the rubber hand illusion as ours.
In the book it's saying that there's the Swiss scientist and made an experiment.
That's the next one, yeah, the OBE, electrode out of body experience. Padine.
Is that true?
It's true.
Is it?
It's true. Well, I don't doubt it. I mean, if Metzinger told a lie about that, that's the end of his career. So I trust Metzinger on these things. He's not a politician.
It predicted.
It's, yeah, it's.
Could it be that, as you said, it's predicting?
Well, why stimulating a certain part of the brain produces an out-of-body experience, I don't think that they're able to explain. They're just saying, well, gosh, isn't that interesting? Yes? But the fact that you can produce an experience of inhabiting another body that isn't your own, a virtual body, under controlled conditions. This is the other thing that I thought you were nearly about to say, is, of course, all of these illusions fall down if you're actually allowed to just walk around freely. Yes? If you're actually allowed to walk around freely, suddenly it all comes back together. You say, oh, no, here it is. Here's my body. Back again. The illusion only lasts so long as these carefully controlled conditions are there. And that's an important point, because the philosophers are tricky people. They say, because we can engineer situations where we show that your experience of your hand is a kind of an illusion, therefore everything's an illusion. And that's one of the arguments underground in what Metzinger's saying, that he's trying to get across the line without explicitly addressing it. But you've got to face the facts. And one of the facts is, your feeling, you've got a kind of a, he's kind of wants to say, you've got a kind of a false theory. You've got a false theory that your hand is actually a sensitive thing, that when the hammer smashes into your hand, the pain is in your hand. And he's saying, well, no, neuroscience tells you that the pain isn't in your hand. The pain is something produced in your brain, and it can be stopped. And the whole experience of your hand being smashed with a hammer can be manipulated, and the whole shock you feel about it can be manipulated. And I can show you now by smashing a hammer onto the rubber hand.
Can it be generated?
Well, we haven't got to the point where we can directly generate experiences by stimulating the brain. It's detailed, full-blown experiences of being in a room. But you can simulate, as he says later on in one of the chapters, you can stimulate experience of smelling something when there's nothing there. There are many experiences you can evoke by mucking around in people's brains, and a lot of brain, you know, because the brain doesn't have any sense neurons in it, so that if you are undergoing brain surgery, you can be conscious. It doesn't. If people start knocking around and cutting into your brain, you don't feel a thing. So, and quite often when you're getting in brain surgery, if you're cutting out a tumour, then it is useful to actually be communicating with the person. Yeah, about can you still speak? You know, because I seem to be going to Broca's area. You know, and if I miscut here, you may not. You know, you still okay? Still okay with the language? Yeah, still okay. You don't.
It's horrible.
Well,
then it's not horrible.
But if you want
your
brain tumour out.
Yeah, no, but you see how it starts to challenge our idea of who we are.
But I mean, when we're unconscious, we don't feel pain. If somebody if somebody's in a coma and they stick a pin in their foot, they don't feel it, do they?
No.
Doesn't mean that somehow their foot isn't real, you know.
No, but it's not just the pain. It's the sensation that you have of your foot being down there can be manipulated by the rubber hand experience, so that you can, even though your foot is down there, you can feel that it's over there. And it's entirely to do with something that's going on in your brain, not in your foot.
Why is that a problem? I don't understand.
It's because we have. I'm just. What Metzinger's. And we're getting into Metzinger now, not what I'm saying.
Okay.
First of all, we've got to get into Metzinger before we say what might be wrong with Metzinger. And we've got to I think, look into the facts of the matter, and we can't, I don't think we can dispute the facts of the matter that he's pointing out, that our entire, what is called body image, is something that is generated by activity going on in our brain. And it's according to the form of that activity determines the experience of the body that you experience having, right to the point where you can, if the right things are going on in the brain, you can feel that you're up on the ceiling looking down on your body. That's, which is an extreme case of it. Although I think, as Maria, you were wanting to say earlier, you're still there, up in the, you know, there's still a self seeing what's going on. You know, that hasn't gone.
Mm.
There's a certain thing at the background here that I just mentioned now, is that there's something that doesn't change throughout all of this, all of these manipulations. The something that doesn't change is there's still a sense of there being a you experiencing it. Whatever, however it's manipulated, you don't get rid of the sense that there's a you there experiencing it. And that's true for all of the kind of weird experiences that I've had in consciousness. I've never finally got rid of this. Even when I would say, oh, I experienced, my ego has died. I remember saying that, oh, my ego's died. It's died, it's gone. But I'm still, you see, there's still someone here registering the fact that the ego is gone. Who's that?
That being and nothingness, can you elaborate on that as well?
Well, yes, I mean, there's a whole phenomenological account of what it is to be conscious that Metzinger is not looking into, which Maria started to look into before we started talking about, and we have been looking into, if you did the first part of the course, you know, the first few lectures we were looking into a pure knowledge of consciousness and what that is, but with it's almost like we're skipping between different levels here. I didn't actually want to get to that quite yet, because we still got to give neuroscience its due, right? Neuroscience has discovered some pretty amazing things that are shocking to what you might call our natural attitude. Our natural attitude says that ain't going to happen. Stroking some rubber hand and stroking my finger, it ain't going to happen that I'm suddenly going to think that the rubber hand's my hand. Just ain't going to happen, because I feel my hand, right? I'm in my hand. You really feel that I feel my hand and I'm in my hand. I'm not in a sort of a brain process. I'm actually in this body, and there is something not quite right about that, right? Neuroscience does demonstrate that. Now, the thing that we have to be careful of here is, because what a lot of people working in cognitive science conclude from that is that we're living a kind of illusion. We're living in a kind of an illusion, and that the reality is what the neuroscientists are discovering is occurring in the brain, that the reality are the physical events happening in the brain, not your experience. And I hope you can see that there's something compelling about that idea, and that these experiments do seem to provide some sort of evidence for that view. And I'd like, without contradicting it, I'd like to sort of regard this class as a sort of a vaccination. This is a kind of a disease you could get. You could get a disease the way you conclude that my entire experience of life is an illusion. But first of all, you have to take some of the medicine, right? Like a vaccination, you have to take a little bit of Metzinger before you can become immune. Maybe you're immune already. So it doesn't matter. But if you're not immune, then you have to, in a way, take a bit of the medicine, right? That's partly what the reading was this week. You've got to take some medicine here, and you take it seriously. You know, not just say, oh, It's all rubbish. It's all science. It's all head stuff. You know, I don't want to know about that, because this stuff is. When somebody in business or government or medicine wants to know about what it means to be conscious, then they go to knock on Metzinger's door or someone like him. When it comes to making decisions that matter in the world, we go to the expert. We want to make some decisions about consciousness, what it means to be conscious. Who do we go to? Do we go to John? Do we go to Heidegger? Do we go to the philosophy department? No, we go to the
right guy.
Yeah, we go to the right guy. We go to the guy who's studied, who's done the science. He's got the answers, or she.
Can't find the person who is conscious now.
That's exactly right. We don't want anyone. We don't go to the guru, do we? Yes. Now the last person you want to talk to is somebody who may be conscious. That's not where you go. So you see it's not just some esoteric thing that there's these guys at the university who spin these yarns and write these books that nobody cares about and nobody's interested in. These are the authorities of this world, and the authorities of this world, and I think I've been trying to get this across in this course. They deeply affect the kind of atmosphere of understanding in which we live. Even though we don't know anything about the details, most people in the street don't know anything about the details of what's being said and what's being discovered. The worldview coming out of this seeps into the culture and determines, in a way, the destiny of the culture. And I think, deeply determines our sense of who we are. And also our sense of what it of the meaning or the purpose of what we're here to do. It isn't just Metzinger and his pals. You know, the thing has deep consequences. That's why I think we need to look at it. Even though I personally now, after many years, and Nicolette just reflected that back to me, I find it very hard to read Metzinger. Almost like, if I'm to describe it phenomenologically, almost like he's sucking the life out of me. You know, the reading of it, I can feel my life is getting sucked in a sort of a strange way. Because you have to be careful with this material.
I wouldn't use that description if you're trying to win favours.
No, I don't have to anymore. Okay. I've retired.
I thought you were trying to create a sort of a little podcast that's going to help convince people.
No. I'm not trying to convince anyone. What counts here is what's true.
Okay.
Yes.
Fine.
But we have names. And these names have meanings, and they're based on stories. So this is the conception, the group conception of what we are.
Yes.
We are stories, somehow.
Well, the conception now that we have is that what we are is the instantiation of a self model in the brain, if to put it in a kind of a.
Is that the phenomenal self model?
The phenomenal self model. Oh yeah, the PSN, and it's even better if you can have an acronym for it. Yeah, it's got far more authority then. Mm-hmm. Let's just look at this. Yes. So what you feel in the rubber hand illusion is the content of the phenomenal self model. Yes. And that's.
Sorry.
What he's saying here is that. That self model, whenever it's active, and what the self model is a certain process going on in your brain, whenever that self model is active, associated with it is a feeling of mindness. Whatever the self model is currently processing, turns into an experience, and the an experience of a self, and the experience of self is always associated with "that's me." And we didn't read the whole book, but he goes into the book, and of course starts to discuss the fact that that's manipulable, and it's particularly manipulable by mental illness. So people can have the sense that there are thoughts that they're having that have been inserted into their heads. You know, most of us, when the thoughts that we experience mindness. That's my thought. I'm thinking that.
It's the foundation of consumerism.
But no, it's the foundation of a sense of a unified self. Is that the things streaming through me? I'm thinking that the thoughts come out of me, but that can break down, you know. And once again, this is more grist to the mill of Metzinger's idea that our idea of self is an illusion, because it breaks. It can be broken down, he also brings up the because he's of our, you know, in of our times, the idea that what people are doing in meditation, when they realize that there's no self, is they're sort of confirming the truth of what he is saying here, that the entire process that's going on in you, that we call your personal self model, that has got two aspects. I'm leaping ahead a bit here. One aspect is the body. Yes, the sense that I am in this body, and this body is me. And the other is the sense of agency. Yes, that not just that I am this body passively, but I'm the agent that speaks and moves and does things. And what Metzinger is getting at about what does he think the illusion is, he thinks it's an illusion that we have any agency, any real agency. And it's an illusion that the body itself is an illusion. And if you look into the brain and the neuroscience of it, and you accept that all that's going on in the brain is that the neurons are behaving as neurons behave, yes? According to the laws that govern the behaviour of the neurons, which is the laws that govern the behaviour of the ions and the electrochemical signals that are being transferred across the brain. There's no agency, there's no I making a decision there at the centre of things. Yes, what the body does is determined by what the neurons do. And the neurons, what the neurons do is they instantiate for Metzinger what he calls a certain self-model, which is just a kind of an executive process that, if you looked at from the outside, is actually determining what you, in quotes, do. But there's no you determining what that process does. You just experience the process doing what the process does. And in experiencing the process doing what the process does in your brain, you get the illusion that there's a you that's doing it, but there's not a you that's doing it. There's just a process in your brain that's doing stuff, and it feels to you like you are that process, but you ain't that process. That process is just a bunch of neurons firing together. Or are you getting fully pulled in? How true this? It's not a lie, right? It's still a hypothesis. It's a hypothesis in the sense that the knowledge of the brain isn't sufficiently detailed that we can say, oh yeah, there's the process, there's the neurons. It has just the structure that Metzinger proposes it has. But I would expect that if neuroscience progresses sufficiently and is able to image the brain in sufficient detail, that this kind of story that Metzinger is proposing will be borne out. Yes.
If there was an agent, I'm going to call it an agent, that had choice, there would be no scientific method of finding the laws that governed that agent. if there were such a thing. Because if there were a way to find the laws that govern that agent, there's no such thing. Like, it's like, effectively, it's like by definition, if there's an agent that has choice outside of the sort of physical laws that you can demonstrate that exist in the universe, whatever, you can't find it and map its influences, because it has choice by definition. I mean, it's like, how do you escape that one? You can't. Sorry.
Well, yeah. You weren't in an earlier class, yeah. But I guess I'd like to remind everyone, just in the midst of all of this, that one of my answers to that there's no agency is to avoid it somewhat subtly, because in actual fact I have a suspicion that an awful lot of what we do is actually just determined by the firing of neurons, but that you can demonstrate absolutely that you're not entirely determined by the firing of your neurons, because you are able to realize that you are conscious. And not only are you able to realize that you're conscious, you are then able to express that in language through your brain. And now the brain, if I just remind you, if it were just a bunch of neurons independent of each other, connected to each other, communicating electrochemically, they could never arrive at an idea of being conscious, in the sense that one realizes what consciousness is. By realizing what consciousness is, you can only really speak metaphorically. You say, oh, there's a light on. There's actually someone here. There's actually some experience here going on that cannot be explained in terms of just purely physical stuff interacting with each other. Apart from the physical stuff interacting with each other, there is my phenomenal experience.
Yeah. You'd argue there's something else other than all that's been observed.
Well, no, you wouldn't argue it.
Yeah.
You know it.
You claim it.
You don't claim it.
You know
it. I am it. This is it.
Okay.
Yeah. It's not. It's
interrupting because I wasn't.
Yes.
Around.
But you don't argue. I'm having that an experience of what he calls the technicolor experience. You don't argue that I'm having a phenomenal technological experience, technicolor.
No, it just is.
It just is, and you can't argue it.
You can't
argue it, and you can't demonstrate it, as you were saying. If you come from the physical third-person side, you can't demonstrate there is anything like consciousness, but there is. Now, if it were all third-person physical stuff interacting with each other, the essential thing that... Because this is the antidote over here. The essential thing is that that system could never formulate any kind of idea of being conscious.
No.
Even if there was consciousness. The consciousness in that model, which is the epiphenomenal model, if you like, which says that consciousness, all right, so there is consciousness, but it has no effect on the matter. If it were the case that it had no effect on the matter, we couldn't be having this conversation.
Haven't they shown, though, that people's intentions actually change the way that the brain is connected up?
No, I mean, not no, but that doesn't get you out of the physicalistic I'm trying to cure you of the disease. Your intention, because they know about intentionality, your intention is just another process in the brain.
It came from all the experiences that are always happening.
No, but we
can always trace it back.
I intend to do something, and look, that changes my brain. Yeah, but your intending was also a process occurring in your brain, and the physical effects of that process change some other part of the brain. It can all be explicated entirely on the physical.
Where did the intention come from then?
The intention came from the previous state of the brain before you had the intention.
That's what they're saying. That's what they're calling. That's the headline of attack.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Not just that, you know, everything that you do, everything that you say, everything that you think. Oh, I just had an idea out of the blue. Well, it looks like that because you're only conscious of 10% of what's going on in your brain. The other 90% is delivering up what you're going to say, delivering up what you're going to do, coming up with an intention, but all entirely beyond, outside of your domain of consciousness. And you say, oh, I just had an idea from out of the blue. Mexicans say that's no out of the blue. It's just a process in your brain that you weren't conscious of, that has now crossed the threshold. And he's about to tell us what the threshold is. Yes.
I need
to get my hand out. So what he's saying is that the personal self model is a certain process going on in the brain. Yes. That can be manipulated. And in some sense or other, at this level of the discussion, it represents your body. And they've mapped this onto the brain, and they know where your body image is in the brain, and they even draw it. It's got this these enormous hands, because you've got tremendous sensitivity in your hands, and the hands have an enormous part of the brain associated with them because they do so much. And your body's this tiny little shriveled thing, you know, with these enormous hands coming off it. I think you've got a giant head as well. And a tiny little shriveled body. You know, you can draw how the body's mapped onto the brain, and that mapping onto the brain, that part of the brain when it becomes active and part of your, because it's not necessarily conscious all of it at one time, but as parts of that become conscious for you, that becomes the content of your personal self model, which is this ongoing process in the brain that is your experience of your body and yourself.
And what
he's saying is, part of the phenomenological experience of that self model is having a sense it's mine, it's me, and that's almost a feeling like the colour red, isn't it?
So is that the ego? Is that what he means by the ego?
Yeah, the ego is the feeling of mindness.
Mindness
that is associated with the activity of that brain process. And he's about to talk about the global ownership, which is to do with the two things, owning and controlling. So owning isn't quite the same as controlling, it's a combination of the two. Because the model, if you like, if you were to look into it and say, what does it represent? It represents your body and all of the processes that are in the currently active that are determining what you're doing. And they're just impersonal, no self in them whatsoever. They're just impersonal events happening in your brain. You just have this sense of ownership of it.
Don't people's self models vary, though?
But your self model varies second by second as well. Different things come into your attentional domain.
If someone's blind, would they experience themselves as having a much bigger hands and...
I don't know. I don't know. And how would they know what... I don't know. I think they would have an accurate sense of the spatial dimensions because they can touch and compare.
Yeah.
Yes?
Yeah. So it's a learned thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
You learn... I mean...
Well, you remember back to Eagleman, and this is quite... This is exactly, we learn to experience a body. We don't start with it. We have to learn it. And we learn it by coordinating our senses.
Mm.
Our sensory, we perform sensory motor loops. We act, and then we see what comes back from the senses, and we connect up the impulse to act and what comes back through the senses, and finally we get a sense of, oh, there's a body thing here. You know, that if I hit that, it doesn't hurt. If I hit that, it does hurt. There's a boundary. There's a me. There's a not me. We have to learn all of that.
Mm. Is that a problem?
No.
Not a problem. I mean, it doesn't mean there's no self, does it? It's just that you have to learn your boundaries of your body.
Yes, but I mean, you see what he's saying. He's saying that your sense of self is just, if we look into the brain, it's associated with a process occurring in your brain that is just occurring in your brain. It's entirely, it's just like any other process occurring, like the stuff going on in the computer. It just so happens that you have an experience associated with this process, and your experience is, this is me. And he's saying, but it's not you. There isn't any you. There's just a bunch of neurons firing away. Are you getting the sickness?
It reminds me of the 1960s like psychologists that were just psychopaths, or 50s or 40s. Wasn't it Pavlov that bloody got kids?
Don't tell me anything nasty. But the gist of this is, what's wrong with this model? That's the gist of it. But first we have to drink deep. I'd like you to imagine, like me, right? Put yourself in my position, that you're at a conference, and instead of me being surrounded by receptive people from the Free University Brighton, I'm surrounded by Metzinger and all his mates.
I would ask for a volunteer to allow me to take some of his neurons out of his brain in front of the audience, because they're not really his, and he doesn't really need them. Or he thinks he needs them, but
it's an impenetrable wall. Of course, I won't let you do that because I can't.
That your neurons came up with.
Because that's true, but nevertheless.
What a terrible argument!
Nevertheless, I am this. I'm caught in the model. Just because Metzinger's saying, as scientists, I can observe the model from the outside, but that doesn't mean that I won't stop you trying to take the neurons out of my brain, because the self model will protect itself, and the self model feels a sense of mindness. You haven't contradicted
true.
It.
True. And it has a right. Well, it doesn't have a right. It has a process to do that.
Yeah, it's a machine that's going to behave the way it behaves, and as long as it's behaving that way, whoever you are, I mean, this is another question we should be asking Metzinger, are going to be identified with it.
Mm-hmm.
Metzinger's only unidentified or disidentified with it insofar as he abstracts himself into his scientific thought mode, which of course for him is another kind of process going on in his brain that is observing his self model. Which in effect would be how he would be describing what we're doing now. We haven't got out of the brain by thinking about the self model, because our thinking about the self model is another kind of process going on in the brain. And you see, the science bears it out. That's not just a fantasy. The science will probably bear it out and has borne it out up until now. Do you get Metzinger feels this. Do you see all of this evidence that we're discovering about how the brain works? It just makes somebody like Heidegger into an irrelevance of some bygone age. Right? He just didn't know the science. He didn't really understand how things work here. He had these kind of crazy semi-mystical ideas. And anyone who's in touch with reality, with the table, with material, with man on the moon, atomic weapons, computer technology, you know, these are all the demonstrations that that science works. And science is now, it hasn't done up until now, it is now going on, it's going to work on you. And it's going to tell you what you are. We discovered what the universe is. It's all of the galaxies, it's the Big Bang. You know, before science, we believed in astrology. You know, but now we know what's out there. Now it's the turn for, and now we're turning our attention onto you. You know what I feel? I say, little man, little woman. Yeah, and what are we discovering? We're just discovering an ephemeral sort of an illusion. Little ephemeral processes going on in the brain. And I'm not saying what's your response yet, but I'm sort of saying, and what are you going to say to that? Now you're in the room with Metzinger and everyone else who don't even blink at that being true. Not even a blink. And they're not just a bunch of oddbods.
Deadly shore.
These have a straw sucking into to funds of millions and millions of dollars, and there are other people who are maybe getting towards the billions who are studying the brain in various parts of the earth. They are plugged into the lake of money, and that's why they count, and they've got not quite unlimited access to it. But if you remember, Bush said the 1990s were the decade of the brain. That meant the money lake was available for this kind of work.
What are they trying to achieve? I mean, if we can discover precisely what parts of the brain control what parts of our sense of this or that, I mean, is there some...
Well, I mean,
some good going to come of this, or some awfulness going to come of this?
Yeah, there's going to be both. There's always both.
Yeah.
Right, so a really detailed understanding of how the brain works is probably going to help a lot in the treatment of mental conditions.
I think the ultimate goal, though, is military.
The other side of it is that if we get a detailed understanding of how the brain functions at this level of being a kind of machine, then we will build those machines.
And we can also write off the thought processes of others as not relevant.
Yeah, we're going to build... The end of the line is quite clear. If it's successful, we've built machinery to replace human labour. We're now going to build machinery to replace mental labour. We're going to build brains. That's the intent, is to build brains to replace our unreliable, costly brains with cheap, reliable, almost infinitely reproducible brains that are going to start to run more and more and more aspects of the world that we live in until we become sort of semi-superfluous.
The only way that could possibly go well is if they accidentally do two good and they actually create a brain that is conscious.
Well,
that's in the best sense of the word.
I think there are reasons why that isn't going to happen, which hopefully we're going to cover in this. It's not going to happen that it's going to be a good thing, let's put it that way.
No, but if they create a brain which is like a weak imitation of us, but actually much better at doing all the rational processing, you'd expect it to wipe
it
out.
It would.
But if they create something that's truly conscious, and consciousness is different to the thing that they've been peddling, then it actually might value life. Just saying. Possibly.
Yes. It could turn out like that. But that's it's hard.
Can you keep going through the slides?
All right. So out of body experiences. Let's go to the cut to the chase here. They can be stimulated by electrodes. And there are also, as we were talking before, you can actually have the experience of inhabiting a virtual body. What these experiences experiments is that the deeper holistic sense of self is not a mystery immune to scientific exploration. It is a form of conscious representational content, and it can be selectively manipulated under carefully controlled experimental conditions. So we have really covered this sense that your entire sense of the ownership of your body is something that can be manipulated and demonstrated to be dependent on and generated by events that are occurring in your brain. And it is. There's a kind of a horrible silence that falls on that, because that is, I think that's true.
I don't think it matters.
No.
I don't mind
all of the, more or less, majority of my experiences being things that occur in my brain.
Yeah.
I'm okay with that.
Okay. But as long as we're we're just bringing ourselves up into the 20th century and the 21st century, this is our ontological understanding of who we are. We used to be souls, right? Inhabiting bodies created by God, came here to seek salvation, and we're going to heaven. Now we've become a process in a brain.
I don't agree with you. I don't think it necessarily follows at all. I mean, if I say to myself, you know, By the way,
you're not agreeing with Metzinger. I'm Metzinger at the moment. I'm right, inhabiting a character.
Okay, well, I'm not agreeing with your character of Metzinger.
Yes.
Because I could be subjected to the rubber hand illusion and, you know, actually feel that the rubber hand belongs to me, or that I could be an out-of-body experience can be generated by a particular illusion or whatever, it doesn't mean that I've got no self. It doesn't follow. I really don't see how that follows. This isn't a threat to me.
Yeah, you're...
Because I'm not just my physical sensations.
Yes. So you're, if I'm going to answer you as Metzinger, I'm going to grant you that you are conscious, and in some sense, being conscious means you have a sense of self.
Yeah.
But as soon as I inquire to you, what is the ground of that sense of self? What is it grounded in?
Mm-hmm.
And Metzinger's answer is that sense of self, the content of it, right? That if it has any content at all, if you were to say, myself is this, is that, is the other, the answer that Metzinger says, well, your self is just the content that is generated by this process going on in your brain. And to think that you own it is an illusion. You don't own the process going on in your brain. It's more the other way round. The process going on in your brain owns you, if you like. It owns you in the sense that it's determined entirely by the physical arrangements going on in your brain, and it generates your experience. So in that sense, the sense of self that you might have of having agency and ownership is an illusion. And I'm not... That's what we're saying. You're sort of saying it's that yes, that doesn't get rid of me.
No.
And I'm still here. And in a way, if we're back with Descartes, the sort of Descartes response is, so in a way, even if it's an illusion, I'm still here experiencing the illusion. I think that's maybe what you're saying. Yeah?
Yeah.
And I think Metzinger would say, yeah, I'm okay with that.
All right. Okay.
Yeah. As long as you've bought it's an illusion, I think you've bought the ego tunnel, the key message of the ego tunnel. Because the key message of the ego tunnel is that your human experience is an illusion and the reality is whatever science tells you it is.
Well, I mean, I couldn't have this experience of consciousness without a brain, could I? So it's got to be, my experience of consciousness has got to be something to do with what's going on in there, I would imagine.
We're nodding, I'm nodding,
but
I'm nodding.
Most people without their heads are probably not very conscious, but that doesn't mean to say that once the brain is there, you know, the ego does not exist, it's just an illusion. It doesn't follow, I don't see that.
No, but you're making a distinction that he doesn't make. One's consciousness is here. Yes, but the entire sense of the meaning of it, the meaning of it being, I'm of what it means to be a self, which means in some sense that you're an independent entity that can act and owns its body and in some sense has some control over what the body does. It's an illusion. The body does what the body does. And your sense of being an agent that owns it is illusory.
Well, I don't control everything. I can't control the fact that I fall asleep eventually.
Yeah, yeah, no, but that, we're not talking about that. He's talking about the bits you think you can control.
Yeah, you don't
control that.
No.
That's a generous illusion your brain's broken.
But the thinking that you do is part of the self model. The self model thinks that.
But he's denying the whole structure of history and everything then, because everything that happens here is led by somebody who has a sense of self.
Yes.
Everything.
Yeah.
Everything since man became conscious.
Yes. And I'd like you to notice as well.
Every man or woman that led or changed the world.
Yes.
Has done anything here.
Yes.
The whole world here now.
Yeah.
Was all by a sense of self.
Yes.
Absolutely.
And he's saying he's.
They all have the same generous delusion.
So he's just wiping all of
wiping. I'm so glad you see this. He's wiping all of that out. It has no meaning whatsoever. It's just a sort of a fictional tale that we've told ourselves.
Is he really saying
he's
that?
Really saying that.
He's really saying that.
Yeah.
Read it again.
Scary stuff, man.
Read it again.
I thought, my God, there's just something creepy in this. Something really creepy.
And then,
not right. Like, not creepy, but I was reminded of Hitler. I was reminded of Hitler when I read it.
Oh, I get that with Heidegger.
No, I was reminded of something very subtle, very convincing, something there that's like, uh-oh, this is really scary. This is really, what's in there in his book. It's really scary. It's not scary, it's of deep concern.
He is deep.
And I'm not influenced by John in that, because I'm like, obviously I know what John's feels about these things, but I actually had it, I thought, no, it was something, because I didn't want to even read it, it was just not really my thing. His work isn't really my thing. But I thought I have to do it and come to the class, but I picked that up this morning. I thought, oh, there's just something not right. There's something not right in this. There's something, but to the point of like, you know, this is going to change how we are here over the next few decades. It's going to change.
I know what you're saying.
And okay, it might, because I said, I think, okay, what value has it? What value does it have value for the fellow men and women? You know, like if it's going to help people with mental health, well then. That would be really great, you know, but there's something else there that's going to really wipe the whole of the quality of being a human being,
yeah.
Of art, of music, the whole quality of being here, love, enjoyment, the whole vast beauty of it here, the mystery of it.
I think it's going to lead to a massive amount of inauthenticity, because you're going to be in a... I mean, if the nightmare scenario that you're...
I mean, I'm not saying you, I don't know, but I'm just...
Let me finish it. If that happens, we're going to be in a situation where you've got an elite that knows perfectly well that they're conscious and that their selves are going to be allowed to treat other people as machines. That's the danger. That's the, sniff of the concentration camps about it.
Like the slave, almost a slavery.
Of course. But you're going to be in a situation where those people are lying to themselves, aren't they? They're going to say, oh yeah, human beings are just machines, you know, that they're not, the sense of self is an illusion. Therefore, ergo, we can treat them like that. But not us!
And the thing to notice... It's
a subtle thing, because people think, when you talk to people and they think, you know, you talk about neuroscience and cognitive science, people think, oh, yeah, no, great, you know. Most people think that's really interesting. I mean, it is to a certain degree, but what's behind it is not quite right.
It's a sinister future, but we're already partly living in it.
I mean, call it the generous delusion as my coin term for how I... refute these people, you know, like, well, I'm blessed with the generous delusion that you don't believe in, that I have some sort of moral authority over my actions.
Yes.
And your argument is no one has any moral authority over anything, because it's all just a generous delusion that their brain has given them. Well, if you want to take that position, you certainly have no moral authority over what actions are taken as time moves forward, because you don't believe in it.
Some people think of it as a liberating.
Okay.
As a very liberating thing, because it kind of liberates you from this kind of self-narrative, all this, like...
Any sense of responsibility as well. Yeah. Any sense of responsibility is off your shoulders. But that's, you know, it's that's just another part of your self-process, your self-model, thinking that.
And just... And just look at it, just for the sake of beauty of it, when you struggle yourself out of bed, and you go like, what is it that's struggling itself out of bed, and why?
So why is there
who
even...
Who knows? Why is that even enjoy the moment.
Why is that even pain? Why would that be such a thing?
Well, we'll be getting rid of that,
maybe,
won't we?
Maybe it points slightly at the value of life. Maybe it relates to the actual, real, intrinsic value of life.
But,
and it's the only real way of knowing it without intellectualising it.
Why would that be stressful? Like, I remember once you said when you were a child, you were looking at this, the sink and how the water goes down to it. But you didn't ask why it happens. You didn't ask why it's coming. You just enjoy it. This. So it kind of turns into something like that, then.
In this view of things, there's a denial of the essence of what it is to be. That's what Nicolette's picking up on. There's a kind of an essential being that we are, and we're now entering into a culture that at the very lowest level wants to deny it. I get the sense that this is what Nicolette intuits. She intuits that. And if you're entirely mental, it's a set of marvelously interesting ideas. So this is very interesting. This idea. Maybe there's no agency. Maybe there's da 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 da. But underneath that, and it's a denial when you say moral authority, it's essentially a denial of all that matters here.
But anyone could even have an argument.
Yeah.
You know,
just a couple of machines.
Yeah. We may as well just.
Yeah.
I mean, they're sort of pointing to, like, there's just no point in being a human being anymore. You know, you may as well just forget the whole planet. I mean, we'll deserve to be wiped out as a human race. I think, you know, really.
But it's okay at a certain level, because it ain't true, and the gist of what this class is about is to get to the bottom of what's not true here, because we're just in a sense our whole culture is in the grip of an illusion, yes, and it's not the illusion of the self. Even though that we may have some illusions about ourselves, it's not. There's another kind of an illusion operating here, which we've been looking at, right? I've been trying to, in some sense, explain the lineage that's come from the scientific revolution and from our materialistic understanding of how the universe is. It's come out of the past, and then it's come out of Darwin and evolution, and this creeping advance of science into more and more domains of our lives, giving us deeper and deeper and surprising explanations about how everything works here, and not just armchair explanations, but explanations that produce technology, that produce changes in the way that we live. The whole process of we're part of this ongoing wave, right? It's only that since I've been here, that it's kind of stepped through, you know, just before I was born, DNA, understanding the cell. Now we're starting to understand, you know, we understand pretty well how the body works, the liver, the heart, the transplant, the kidneys, the lungs, the blood, the oxygen, the reproductive nature of the cells, how the DNA works, how the protein works, and for a long time, the brain, too complex, consciousness, something weird about consciousness, but it's now the progress of this machine is now it's reached to our being, our very being here.
The observer.
Yeah, it wants now to assimilate us. science wants to assimilate us. That's another way of putting it. And this is the beginning. Metzinger's account is the beginning of how we're going to be assimilated into that. So that our understanding of what we are joins our understanding of course the sun doesn't rise in the east. We go round the sun. We know that. Yes. It's not earth, air, fire, and water. It's all the elements and the molecules and the atoms. We don't doubt that now. We don't say no. I'm still back with the medieval. It's all earth.
It was shocking. Yeah. These findings were shocking.
But the findings that he's demonstrating here about the fact that our entire experience is being determined by processes going on in the brain, they're shocking factual discoveries. Do you see? That weren't available to us. People may have thought, well, it could be that way, might not be that way, but now we're doing the science, we're doing the experiments. It's no longer out there as a matter of opinion.
So I think if you have a look closely at the last paragraph on there, what he says on page 6. So he says that a deeper holistic sense of self is not a mystery immune to scientific exploration. Well, I don't think anybody would contest that you can't explore the sense of self. I mean, psychologists and psychiatrists have done this for a very long time, haven't they? About different aspects of the self, the ego, the id, and so forth and so on. And I think when,
have you finished the sentence?
If you unpack it, then it kind of falls apart, because the first thing he says is suggesting that not to explore the brain is suggesting that the self is a mystery, and I'm saying no, it bloody isn't, and it wasn't considered as such. It was is being considered as something that's studyable for a very long time. That's the first thing.
The origin of the ego and the id and the superego in the processes in the brain suggested by Freud was a neurological scientific. Freud was a materialist. Freud would be going along with this. Freud would be okay with this. This doesn't deny Freud.
No.
It grounds Freud.
Well, I don't know, because I think a lot of people say that Freud isn't scientific anyway, but
they don't. They say that what he proposed isn't falsifiable, but he was scientific. His impulse was he was a scientific materialist. It's Jung, you want to say. If the word mystery would refer to Jung, and his idea of there being a collective unconscious that vastly transcends the brain, and that there's a collective memory out there in the psyche that isn't associated with any brain. That would be the.
But yeah. My point about Freud is that the reason why, for a lot of people, he's convincing is because he describes your experience. And you can say, oh yeah, I had a dream, and that dream does point to my anxieties about such and such.
Yes.
It's not to do with the, it's not convincing because he points to bits of your brain. It's convincing because he reveals yourself to you.
Yes, but what this approach is going to do is it's going to say, well, let's discover whether Freud was right. What kind of process is a dream? And what does the dream represent? And if we have a proper understanding of the brain, we will be able to trace that back into the brain, and we'll be able to see how dreams function. And when we say, is there a superego, we will be able to say, well, if there's a superego, then that will be associated with some kind of process going on in the brain. It's either there or it ain't. We're going to make Freud scientific. Yeah, and it's not until we have that deep understanding of the processes that are going on in the brain and the experiences that they generate that we're going to have any kind of scientific psychology. At the moment, we've been doing the best we can because we don't know the full facts.
No, I'm taking issue with what he says about it being a mystery. You know, just because it might not be a, you might not be able to map it onto the brain or it's something.
But it is it is a mystery. We don't know that there's a superego. All that Freud proposed was a kind of a best guess based on indirect observation of what's going on in your brain, namely the testimony of individuals.
And also, for example, the inhibition. Before you thought that inhibition is just a moral thing because we are a moral being, that's why we inhibit ourselves. But science, scientific findings, it just explains how inhibition happens.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, with Freud saying that everything is basically a repression of infantile sexual urges, well, that's going to be a testable hypothesis now. Right. Not it has.
Well, it's been tested, these things, I think. Inhibition. How the brain kind of
inhibits. Yes, but we're still a long way off from saying, ooh, that process going on in the brain there that we're observing with our brain scanner means this. It's not a all we can say is, oh, you're thinking of a tennis match, and that bit of your brain lights up.
Yeah.
And so, say, a similar area lights up with a load of other people, but what the scanner says is there's more oxygen there. It's a very blunt instrument. It doesn't say exactly what it is about the firing of those neurons that represent a tennis match. Now, we may get down to the point where we do know that. Science is there, is going to have laid out your entire life for you. It's going to say it's all explicable in terms of what's happening in your brain.
The ultimate proof, one of the ultimate proofs would be just to create a carbon copy of a functioning person that basically behaves exactly the same. You're like, there you go, there can't be a self, we've produced you.
Yeah.
And it does exactly what you would do. So how can you should associate as much with that as the one that you're in?
The other thing is we develop some kind of amazing nanotechnology that can actually start to interact with your brain. And we just say, okay, you're now going to go to Australia.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha. There? Yeah, here I am. You're now going to be upstairs in your bedroom. Oh, yeah. Yeah, we just stimulate the right neurons. You get the right experience. We know we've got the theory right.
Yeah.
Yep, we know we've got the theory right now. Because we understand it all. And now you can have any life you like. That's another technological end that could be achieved through this. Instead of having the internet, instead of having a virtual life through the internet, you basically plug it straight in your brain.
Just have any type of life.
And you can have any body you like. It's all in Avatar, right?
And they can also explain.
It's all in the movie Avatar.
They can also explain our defensive attitude towards these scientific findings that.
Yeah.
Also
oh yeah. Everything's explicable. Right. A few minutes before lunch. You know, there's only 28 slides, and we're on slide 5, so we're bound to finish. I thought we might take 2 weeks on this, so I've factored that in, by the way, because I think it's important. You know that it said science, consciousness, and the brain, and this it's supposed to be a third of the course in a way. So that it's the brain at the moment. That we're looking at. And the next thing he wants to say, and this is where we get, this is where we start to get some definite, something to get hold of in a way, with the idea of the ego tunnel, right? Because he wants to say that our conscious experience is like a tunnel. His picture of it is that the tunnel really is generated by the neurons that are firing in your brain. But that what you experience is what those neurons are generating. Do you see that it's a tunnel because it's not, we're not interacting with the world. We're interacting, our experience is the experience of the firing of these neurons. And these neurons, if you like, are they're presenting the walls of the neuron, this the neuron tunnel, painted on it, this is what he wants to say, this is his analogy, is this room. And that your experience of yourself is the experience of another process that's inhabiting the tunnel. So you've got the tunnel and its inhabitant are together interconnected into this one reality generating process in the brain. This is why it's a tunnel. I'll read it out. What we see and hear, or what we feel and smell and taste, is only a small fraction of what, I'm bolding it deliberately, actually exists. I'd like to bold, mm-hmm. out there. You see, there's some monster philosophical terms, right? Actually exists. So he knows what actually exists, right? Please tell us, Thomas, so you know what actually exists. And not only that, what actually exists is out there. So does that mean that what's in here doesn't exist? What are you saying, Thomas? He's starting to use words that now it starts looking very questionable. Because up until now, he's saying there are these processes going on in the brain. And they, you change them, you change your experience. There's nothing really going on in your foot. Da, 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 da. But now suddenly we've leapt into something else here about what is real. That's when as philosophers, this is when the alarm bells start ringing. So what do you make of all of these facts, right? And suddenly we've got what we would call an ontology. We've got an idea of what actually exists. We've got an out there, which means we've got an in here. And then we've got our conscious model of reality, right? That's what... For him, that's what we experience. It's a low-dimensional projection, and this is all of the Metzingers are like this.
You should not have a hierarchy. It's a bit more neutral, I think.
It's the inconceivably richer physical reality. Now, I've been reading Jung about this. At the bottom of materialism, and I think he might be right here, is a myth of matter being the mater, being the mother. That actually matter, for a materialist, is a kind of a god. And you can catch this happening when a card-carrying materialist starts to describe matter as inconceivably richer.
It's not a very scientific way.
All praise matter. All praise matter. Don't anyone say anything against matter. Because matter made you.
Is that a quote of his?
It's not. I'm just ramping it up, right? That's
it is. Yeah.
That's straight out of the book. It's all Metzinger.
Good.
Yeah.
I picked up on that as well.
Yeah.
The inconceivably richer physical reality.
Inconceivably, because matter's so much greater than.
Yes.
Our mother. Mater, matter,
I know
mother.
There's a lot of rabid atheists. When you tell them stuff like that, they perk up, they really love it, and they start liking you. For that reason.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's easy to manipulate.
Where you've got to watch, whenever anyone uses superlative language or strong adjectives, they're actually, if we're being psychologists, they're revealing something behind what they're saying. And yes.
But I think my reaction to that particular sentence was, if it's inconceivable, how are you conceiving of it?
Well, we conceive of it through our model of reality.
Yeah.
Except that he's a member of the club, the priesthood, really, who knows it's not real, who have a greater conception of it. The conception of it that he has is the scientific conception.
Yeah, but he's only looking at his own experience of what he's seen through instrument.
But beyond that, he's built a model of what reality really is.
They're telling each other they're the top of the tree. They're just saying... you've got your
ego tunnel model and your self model, but Metzinger has another model, a model that explains those little models, and that it that places them within the greater reality. What he's saying, put in a nutshell, is that all we ever know are models, and the scientific model is a meta model that is correct. It's a correct model, and the model that you have, your self model, your ego tunnel world model, is an incorrect model.
Well,
and the best we can do here, we can't ever be actually in touch with reality. The best we can do here is have a correct model. And the correct model is science.
Well, it is up to a point, isn't it? But it's
our best guess.
It's incomplete.
In a lot of situations.
I mean, the scientific model is correct if you want to explain how best to produce a table that stands up.
It depends. It depends. Is the scientific model correct when the model itself attempts to determine, and I quote, what actually exists?
No, it's meant to remain falsifiable for as long as science exists.
So there are certain presuppositions behind Metzinger's model, if you like, that aren't taken as hypotheses, they're taken as givens,
yeah.
Right? And what actually exists is one of the givens of Metzinger's model. All models rely on a presuppositions, yes?
I mean, it was...
But he doesn't... The science in general, and specifically with Metzinger, don't... aren't thinking in that way. He's thinking in the sense that the model, the scientific model, is, let's be fair to him, he's not saying it's 100% correct, he's saying it's more correct than any other model you could possibly have. And if it's incorrect, it's in the nature of science that it will correct itself. So it's got a kind of an infinite task towards greater and greater correctness, and any other approach, you know, human level approach, is mired in an illusion of the illusion of the ego tunnel. He and a few of his friends, they've got out of the tunnel, at least for their moments of scientific lucidity. They may fall back, you know, when they get on the bus and go home. And in fact, I suggest that Metzinger, in fact, hasn't entirely left his ego tunnel when he's writing about himself and all of the famous scientists that he knows, and what an important guy he
and
is.
I met him.
Yeah.
and we founded this organization together.
There's a certain sense of maybe there's a Metzinger ego even active when he's being scientific. So
the tunnel, I just need to get this because
I
think it's hard to get the whole concept.
This guy, so it's Michael Wilson, he's got a very nice way of explaining the reality tunnel and the ego tunnel and all of that. And he explains it in a kind of in a comic way where you like really laugh at it. It's real nice.
But what he's saying, right, is the reality, if you like, is this process going on in the brain.
So it's a
tunnel in the sense, firstly, that you're trapped inside your skull.
Right, because you just said the tunnel was the neurons or something. The neurons
in their activity generate the tunnel.
And the tunnel, as far as I'm concerned...
And then me inside is the ego, right? Me.
And there's another process that generates your self-model and your sense of agency. That's, again, it's the neurons acting together, instantiate a certain activity in the brain, and when that activity is present, you experience yourself as a self with agency owning a body. And if you take a laser and you smash that process, then smash goes your sense of self. But your sense of, he's saying, it's your sense of self is the activity of that process. And your sense of there being a world is the activity of the neurons in your brain that are responsible for every aspect of what you're experiencing now. Responsible in the sense that if they weren't doing what they're doing in your head, then there wouldn't be no world here for you.
Just a quick one. I think the word tunnel's like, okay, you need some sort of word, but it's just chosen.
It's a metaphor, yeah, it's a metaphor.
Words,
yeah.
To say that there's an escape from the tunnel. So he's putting everything in, like, well, this is higher and this is lower. So that's what I'm saying. Keeps on, like, supposedly neutral scientific person, yet framing different concepts in terms of, like, a hierarchy as to which ones are actually good and which ones are bad. And it's like, that's a moral thing to do, and yet you're meant to be a science.
But it's not just a moral thing. He really thinks that the tunnel is a tunnel, because outside of it, outside of the activity of our neurons, outside of the activity of the neurons, there is the actual, really real world.
The inconceivably richer.
The inconceivably, the mater.
Yeah.
The mater lives outside. And the tunnel is just a kind of a low dimensional kind of projection, like a movie that's presenting you with a kind of a narrow, tiny little slit of the inconceivably richer reality that lies outside. Hence, it's a tunnel, because in a way, the sense is that it cuts us off.
But that's sort of a moral projection that he's put onto what otherwise could be scientific.
Yes,
that's all.
Yeah. But I feel with Metzinger, he's saying, well, it's a tunnel, because your sense is that you're not in a tunnel, that your sense is that you are in touch with the inconceivably richer reality around you. That's the sense of being a human being, right? You have that sense, and he's saying, no, you're in a tunnel. You're in your head. And you're just experiencing a process going on in your head. So you see, it's metaphorically expresses what he wants to say.
There's a positive version of interpreting all of this as well. Roughly like, if he's now going to produce a model where we actually experience the inconceivably richer physical reality and actually experience it.
Yeah.
But I don't know that we can.
Well, I'm about to suggest, I don't like to say this, that in fact we are experiencing the inconceivably richer reality right now.
Yeah.
In fact, we all think that, don't we? We all come ready primed with that, and he's saying that's an illusion, and I'm saying, well, are we going to stand up for the poor, benighted human race here in the face of all of this science?
Well, my feeling is always that there probably is a reality that's richer than what I experience. I mean, bats can hear sounds that I...
Yeah, but that's like saying, well, there is. There's Cisbury Ring. You know, but I can go and visit it. I don't get it all at once.
No, exactly.
No, but that would be nonsense, wouldn't it?
I was going to say, I think we get what we need.
Yeah, yeah. But if you want to know what the bats are experiencing, at a certain level, you can... You can develop instruments that will relay back to you, and I bet you could actually plug one into your brain. I bet they're going to be doing that. You could, because blind people, you know, they do a bit of clicking.
Yeah.
They can do clicking, and actually from the echo get the beginning of a bat sense of space from the way that the sound's reflected. Yeah. So it's
formulation more.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. All right, it's. Go on 12, so we'll, you know. It's been a trying time, hasn't it?
Very trying.
There's another idea, the ego tripping.